I take great pleasure in introducing to you our main speaker for the morning, Harriet R. from Miami, Florida.
I've just been told I can talk until 10 after 12. So get ready. I may not go that long, but at least I know what my goal is. Isn't it interesting, as soon as our 10-minute speakers were finished, and we had to, and I want to thank you so much for both of you for sharing, you said we're going to read the traditions. Everybody got up to get their cigarette break and go to the bathroom, because it's traditions. That's when you leave the room, right? Traditions are why it works. Traditions are why we're here, I believe. I believe it weren't for the traditions, something might have happened to us. Our traditions tell us that we have a singleness of purpose, that we are here in unity. And a little example of unity came about just not too long ago, and I'll share it with you. On a Friday evening, I decided to call my friend Linda, who's here with me this weekend. She moved after 20-some years in Miami, Florida. She moved to Mesa, Arizona. And she was packing to go to a women's AA retreat. And she says, I'm leading a meeting tomorrow morning on rigorous honesty. And so we talked a few minutes. And the next afternoon, it's 2 o'clock on Saturday, where I go to a meeting every day, Saturday when I'm in Miami. So I talk to people in any big city or even behind the Iron Curtain today and find Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you looked at the literature rack out there with those books in Japanese and Russian and Czechoslovakian and Polish and all those languages? We're everywhere today. You can't miss us. You can't miss us. And so I said, we have unity, and I said, I looked at my watch, and even as we speak and start this meeting today at 2 o'clock on rigorous honesty, out in Mesa, Arizona, Linda is closing a meeting on rigorous honesty. So it must be important. My name is Harriet. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. I live in Miami, Florida. I'm a member of the Coral Gables group. If you're in Miami, I'm in the phone book. My initials are HP, as in higher power. And I welcome phone call. The last name is Rawls. The program has me as somebody else, and she couldn't get here. I don't know who she is even. It was just a typographic error. I'm an only child, and I think it's important. I've met an awful lot of people in AA who are only children. We start out selfish and self-centered. Particularly when you come from a loving home as mine was. At one time in my early sobriety, I took an inventory with the idea of blaming it all on my parents. And that was even before it became fashionable to do that. And I could find no reason, because my parents loved me. And they gave me everything that I needed and most anything I wanted, including a good education and pretty clothes and extra things like going to dancing schools to learn not only dancing but my social manners, and private schools where we wore the uniform for the day. And I had my own car when I was 15 years old, didn't have a driver's license until I was 16. And the cops knew it. They just said, oh, that's Al Park's daughter. She's okay. And I was treated as somebody special. At dancing school, we learned our manners. And one of the things we learned was how to begin to date the opposite sex. And one of my early dates at the age of 10 or 11 was a blonde, curly-headed boy by the name of Freddie. And Freddie was a member of well-known family in our area. He was the Stegmeyer Peer family up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And we always had a case of Stegmeyer beer in our refrigerator. And we also always kept a case of Bartell's beer because they too were family friends. And later I moved down to Philadelphia And there we drank Fetz beer because Carl was a family friend, and I dated Carl. And I remember these names. This all happened a long, long time ago. But I was telling this story just a month ago when I was asked to speak at a meeting in Fort Pierce, Florida, which is up toward the center of the state on the coast, the East Coast. And after the meeting, and I heard in recent years that little Freddie, blonde, curly-headed Freddie, drank too much of his own beer and died young as a result or indirect result of alcoholism. And I cried a little bit because Freddie was adorable. And we drank together in our teens and early 20s, and we were good friends. And after this meeting in Fort Pierce just about a month ago, a girl came up to me, about a woman of 30 or so, and I shiver now. She says, "I'm Freddie's great-granddaughter. I'm Freddie," and she had blonde curly hair. And it took me back to those early days when we didn't know we were alcoholics. We were just having a good time drinking. I think only children and special children in the family do get to AA pretty quick. We don't have statistics on that, but I've heard an awful lot of it. I believe I was instant alcoholic. I had my first drink when as medicine. My parents were late night people. They loved to play cards, and along about 11 o'clock, someone would say, "Well, let's go over to Ray Huddle's and get some lobster and steamed clams." And being an only child, they'd pack me up and take me along. And I can remember being handed a glass of, a very small glass, and it was brown and it was bitter and it had stuff on the top that made my lips all fuzzy white. And they said, "Drink it down, it will help your indigestion." I did not have indigestion, but I drank it and I made a face and I swallowed it and it was bitter and I said, "Oh my goodness, isn't this good?" Because I immediately became a grown-up person. I became part of that lobster-eating crowd at 11 o'clock at night, and I was somebody special. I did not start to be a falling-down drunk at that age, but at age 15, I was getting ready to go away to college in the fall. I had graduated from high school and entering that year, and I got the measles. And our family doctor prescribed a little port wine to get my strength back. And I'll tell you, that port wine will do it. Especially with an indulgent father as I had, who thought that a little port wine came in a big bottle. And he left it at the bedside. And he thought a 15-year-old girl going off to college in the fall certainly could take care of herself. And when they came back a little while later, I had drunk the whole bottle. I had vomited and passed out and waked up and said, "Wasn't that good?" I did not drink too much, too often, and too long and become an alcoholic. I don't know exactly what that means when you tell me that you crossed over some invisible line. I know in my own heart for me that the reason I had to drink so much and so often and so long was because I was alcoholic. All through my life, people told me not to drink like that. And I never knew what they meant. I only knew one way to drink. And it was alcoholic from that first medicinal drink at age 9 or 10. I was a happy girl. I was given lots of nice things. I sometimes wonder, though, about the talk today taken not from the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, but from one of the stories. And it says, "We're happy, joyous, and free." My sobriety... And right here, I guess I should say my sobriety date is January the 14th, 1956. And of those two young people who blew out the candle, we started out exactly the same way. I didn't have the candle to blow out at the end of the marathon, but I had the same kind of sobriety that you do right now, this moment. First a few hours and then a few days. You don't get 34 years without 34 months and 34 weeks and 34 days and 34 hours and sometimes 34 minutes. And sometimes 1 minute at a time. And my sobriety, 34 years, has not what I would call happy, joyous, and free every darn minute of the time. I think that's for idiots. Not too long ago, we had our Florida State Convention in Daytona. This is very interesting. Your program has speakers from the East Coast, Virginia, Georgia, and Florida. Our convention had everybody from California. Maybe we could get together and meet in the middle. Amazing. Barney was there. I saw him yesterday. Cliff R. was there. Several others from California were there. Gave us marvelous messages. But as we were leaving Sunday morning, it was announced that one of the committee members had to get ready to leave early because his mother had just died. And so we all kind of, we gave a round of applause. I don't know what for, but I guess, you know, we certainly were not applauding his mother's death. But as we were leaving the auditorium, one of our young members happened to be walking alongside of me, and he's so dedicated, and he's working with the H&I, and I love to tell people what these initials stand for. Some people go through all their sobriety not knowing what an H&I is, and he helped them, I don't know, Ivy or something, but H&I are hospitals and institutions, and he's very active in the hospitals. And I'd love to know how many people here today know what CPC means. We talk with all these initials, GSRs and DZMs, and you know, if you're interested, find your delegate. And if nobody knows who the delegate is, you know, call me. I'll find out for you. I believe in general service. It saved my life, and I hope to tell you about that. But he's in a hospital, working in a hospital. He's doing so well. But as we walk down the aisle together, he says, "I'm having a problem, Harry." He says, "I can't get happy, joyous, and free all the time." I said, "Well, do you think that man whose mother died this morning, do you think he's happy, joyous, and free and jumping up and down?" And he looked at me and said, "Well, I guess not." And I said, "Do you think that all these people in here are happy, joyous, and free every minute of the day? We face life head on. And that's what our program is all about, to stay sober and to carry the message of the suffering alcoholic." And if we do our best to be of maximum service to our fellow man and to God, we may become happy and joyous and free some of the time. But our primary purpose and our real purpose is to be of service to others. I graduated from college at the age of 19. I had a Bachelor of Arts degree, and I was supposed to be a school teacher. And you want to be very glad I didn't teach anybody in this room. My father told me we're broke. It is amazing to me today, in 1990, that back there in 1936, I had no idea that my father was struggling financially to get me through college, that there was the biggest depression of all time on, and that we had been facing bankruptcy for a long time. But he struggled and struggled to get me through college and to send me pretty dresses, and my mother would tell me when to wear them, and I would bring friends home from college, and we had a lovely home in the country outside of Wilkesboro near Harvey's Lake. Some of you recognize that territory. They could have wonderful parties, and it was a lovely social life. I had a marvelous childhood. However, I can remember my father taking up golf, and once in a while he would be a little late getting home from the golf course, and there would kind of be laughter, and they said, "Well, he's stuck on the 19th hole." Well, nobody had to tell me what the 19th hole was. I was attuned to anything to do with alcohol. I believe I have what Dr. Silkworth calls I had the awareness of alcoholism. I don't think I had yet the obsession that is part of our threefold illness, but I was aware of alcohol from that moment I had that first beer at Ray Hoddle's. And so when I heard 19th hole, somehow it just fit in. And at about the same time, we were getting, this was in, I guess you haven't even heard of Prohibition, some of you. You're very young. But there wasn't a thing as Prohibition back then. And you've got your booze from a bootlegger. I was a child of probably 14 and 15 when this was happening, I believe, and very immature. When I was graduating from college at 19, I was still 13 and 14 in the mind. I was a very immature child. And so we had a very large house. And there were a lot of doors. One door we called the preacher's door. Nobody had a door knocker on it. Nobody came there except the preacher, and he stopped coming early. The back door was the grocery delivery. And over here was the paper and the milkman and different doors. And then there was the back door upstairs where our friends came, and that's where when the bell rang at a certain time of the evening, we knew that Andy Bittenbender was bringing the booze, and I would go and get it, and it was in a brown bottle, and it was called Rittenhouse. And I don't think that normal 13-year-old kids remember these names. You know, Andy Bittenbender is not a John Smith. And the booze was called Rittenhouse, and we put it in the bathroom, and it was considered medicine, until somebody wanted a highball. And then they'd go up to the bathroom and get the bottle and bring it down, and they used jigger glasses, and they'd measure and put a great big bunch of ginger ale on top of it. And sometimes there was some left, and I drank it. I was always aware of it. I learned how to giggle and react when I had a sip of Daddy's highball. And it was instinctive. I just knew how to act. Always aware. And later it became the obsession. And so Daddy said, "We're broke. You better get a real job and make money." And so they sent me to a secretarial school. And I became a good executive type secretary. And I earned my living from then on. But it also was the end of parental and teacher management. I had been told what classes to wear, what boys to bring home the second time, which fellows not to date, which fellows to date. And it had all been managed for me. So I got a job with the federal government. And my first job was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I moved away and got me a new manager. My new manager told me what clothes to wear, what dresses to wear, what boys to go out with a second time, what group crowd to go with, and my new manager was alcohol. And alcohol managed my life right up to the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in January the 14th, 1956. Alcohol told me how to live. They told me what to do at all times. And when I began missing work on Mondays and the absenteeism started, I decided I'd better start changing drinks. And when I found myself going over into Camden, New Jersey, and being over there on weekends, Saturday nights and Sunday, because of the blue laws in Pennsylvania, I began to realize that there was something a little wrong with my drinking. And I had a room in front of in what we call the Girard Estate. I don't know if it's still there or not. But my room was in a private home, and it had a basement though, and I was directly over the front porch. And the front porch had one of those slanty roofs with the trough to catch rain and snow and everything. And it was cold enough in Philadelphia that I could keep my beer on the window. Gretz beer, of course, because I was dating Carl. I would leave the windows open in such a fashion that they'd stay cold, but I could still, I decided to take up a hobby, and it wouldn't drink so much. And the hobby was painting by the numbers, 10-cent store stuff. And I did not do any masterpieces, but even though I was doing this to keep from drinking so much, I had at least 6, 7, 8 bottles of, big bottles of beer lined up on the windowsills. And one evening I'm painting away, and I reached over for one of the bottles, and accidentally, of course, I knocked one out. And it rolled down that slanty roof and down into the gutter. And I didn't think twice about it. I just went right out head first. And I stood down the roof through the snow and the ice, and I got my bottle, which was the important thing. And I turned around, and I had to claw my way back up through the snow and the ice. And it occurred to me that this was not social drinking. And I began doing all the things the book says. I began switching drinks. I tried not drinking in the morning. I tried not drinking here. I tried switching to wine. I had moved, at one point I moved over into, like Pat said last night, I'll kill her. I moved over into Virginia because it was a dry state. This was later on. And in Virginia, it was a dry state. And I thought, well, that'll keep me from drinking. And I found out I had to go to the ABC store, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Store, to get my booze. But right there in the apartment complex was a grocery store that sold those wonderful gallons of wine. $89.99 for a gallon. And that's when I became a wino, or winette, I guess. They told us back there in Philadelphia that we were going to be transferred to Camp Lee, Virginia, Petersburg. And they must have told us the reason, but I was so busy enjoying life and having a good time, and I did. I hope that you've had some good times with your drinking. Not many, but much, but I hope you had some, because I had a wonderful life. I really did. I went down to Camp Lee to work at the Quartermaster School, and it was in December of 1941, on a Sunday that Pearl Harbor came along. And it was, it just went over my head. You see, my self-centeredness had me living in a dream world. And I went to a lot of movies, and I had lived in the country, and I read a lot of books, and I lived in a dream world, a fantasy world. And so when Pearl Harbor was bombed, I thought it was sort of a special movie being put on for my entertainment. And on Monday, when I went into work, some of the fellows who had started out on their Christmas leaves were back, and I made jokes. I said, "What are you doing back from your Christmas leave?" And they looked at me as if I were from outer space. And I was completely ignorant of what was going on in the world. Today I wonder. I had a decent, good education, and I did not even understand what was going on in the world around me because it was all me. As long as I was having a good time, and it wasn't strictly selfishness, it was just plain self-centeredness. And it was the root of all my problems. Still is today. And it's still a problem that I live with and try to get better, improving, growing. Very soon I was threatened with being demoted. I was secretary to the colonel. Because of my absenteeism, and sometimes when I had a bad hangover, my work wasn't the best. And so I was being threatened with demotion. And of course, about that time, they were forming the women's services in World War II. And I looked over the uniforms very patriotically. And I decided that I discarded the wax. I didn't want to be a women's army auxiliary person. And I really liked that Marine Corps uniform. In World War II, they wore khaki, olive drab type uniform. But what got to me was the red ascot tie and a red silk cord around the cap. And it was me. I was a brunette, and I was thin, and I was pretty, and that was just what I needed. And so when the time came that I just couldn't make it to work, and I knew if I did go to work, that would be the day they would put me back in the pool or something, and I just took off for Richmond. And I went to Richmond, Virginia to sign up for the Marines, and I didn't dare drink, even though I needed to drink badly. And I was, I looked good on the outside. In fact, I just picked up some snapshots the other day and looked at them, and I said, "Damn, I look good." But I remember how I felt inside. Inside, it was all that insecurity and the guilt and the nerves and the butterflies and the crying out for a drink to settle those nerves. And I was an actor. I just would smile and pretend everything was fine. And sometimes after we come into AA, we do the same thing after we're not drinking and we're hurting. And we smile and say, "Everything's okay." And we don't share with our sponsors or with our friends. And we continue to hurt until we learn how to share. And if you new people are nervous and shaky and insecure, share with the person who's with you. Find someone who's sober longer than you are if you haven't found a sponsor yet, and unburden them. You know, back in our great-great-grandmothers told us that shared pleasure is double pleasure. Well, with misery, it's the other way around. If we share our misery, it lessens it. We give it to our friends, so they have some of our misery, you know. But don't hide it. Don't keep those secrets. The secrets will kill you, and you're going to hear that a lot here in AA. Don't keep any secrets. Share them. I keep losing my train of thought. It doesn't matter. It's all going to come out right. I went up to that Marine office, and I got there, and I needed that drink, and I was shaking, and I was trying to put on this act of being good, because I wanted to be a good Marine, you know, John Wayne type. And so he swore me in, and he shook my hand, and he said, "Welcome to the United States Navy." And I remember very well kind of backing up and saying, "Oh, sir, I came here to join the Marine Corps." And he said, "I'm sorry, honey, you got off on the wrong floor. You're in the Navy now." And he had signed me up to go to officer training school, and I said, "I don't want to be an officer." He says, "Oh, look at this fine education, your background. You'll make us a fine leader." Oh, boy, what kind of leader they got, I'll tell you. And so they did send me to officer candidate school, Smith College up there in New England somewhere, and at Northampton, Massachusetts. And I became an ensign. And later on, they promoted me to junior grade lieutenant. But the best thing of all, they assigned me to the Supply Corps. And I had 8 warehouses to take care of. They gave me 8 seamen to do the work. And they gave me a pickup truck. They gave me a Jeep. Oh, how I love my Jeep. And wonder of wonders, they gave me a forklift truck. Now, my 8 seamen were the ones to run the forklift truck and the pickup. The Jeep was mine. Very quickly, the forklift truck became mine after the 2, 3, 4 martini lunches. And I would get up there on that forklift and I would run the forks up and down and from one end of the warehouse to the other. And you remember we wore short skirts. I see they're coming back now, but we wore short skirts in World War II. And I would be up there with those pedals a flying and my forks walking down and my 8 seamen rolling on the floor laughing and having a good time with everything. Until one day, and this is the first time that I can place it in my memory, one of those young men whose name was Cece, we called him Cece, one of them spoke up and he said, "What's the matter with you? You act like us. You talk like us. Where'd you learn that kind of language? You're not nice anymore. We don't like you anymore." And like I was to do so many times in the future, I turned around and pretended I did not hear him. But I was to hear that many times. "What makes you act like that? Why do you talk like that? Where'd you learn that kind of language? And don't drink like that." Like that. That's how else do you drink? When you're an alcoholic, that's the way you drink. And World War II came to an end, and I got through it because of the enablers. These enablers all through my life, my parents and my senior officers in the Navy and my friends at work, they all covered for me. They nearly killed me with their kindness. And we can do that to an alcoholic. And if you're new and people are killing you with their kindness, you may not recognize it. But don't let them cover up for you. Now that you're sober, you're going to learn how to live your own life. You're going to learn to turn it over to a power greater than yourself. At first, it may be the group. It was for me. But you'll find the power of your own choosing. Choose your own conception of God. Not mine or anybody else's. But it's here for you and it's free. You've paid your dues already to get here. And we welcome all the newcomers. I decided that I'd had enough of the services and that I better get back in the real world. And I was a little jealous of some of my friends who had gone overseas. We waves didn't go overseas in those days. Oh, I forgot to push my button on my clock and I still have 40 minutes to go. So I was in the Pentagon building one day, and I saw a recruiting sign, and next thing I knew, I was in Algiers, North Africa. Now, I got there before Humphrey Bogart and Casablanca, but I got there right after Charles Boyer, and also right after General Eisenhower. We moved into the hotel that he vacated, and this was in 1940. I don't know, I forget the date. But it was right after the World War II had ended, and our mission was with the Graves Registration. It was not the happiest of assignments, but I was the happiest drunk they had there. They found out I could play the piano, and I became the Sunday morning hymn player. But I had to have a few drinks before I could make my fingers hit the keys, and sometimes I'd had one or two too many, and those hymns would get pretty heavy. They never did let me do a funeral service. They couldn't do it. But that's where I met my Arab. Now, my Arab wasn't any ordinary fellow. He was a chieftain. He was a mayor of they call him a Kayid. A Kayid is a mayor, and he was the Kayid of an oasis called Busada. And I went with my Arab, and we went to Busada, and we rode our camels into the sunset. And I truly believed that I was going to dwell forever in a tent with oriental rugs on the floor, with a little boy over there fanning me, and that someone was going to feed me grapes. And not too long ago, on television, I saw the exact replica of this tent. And I looked for my Arab, and I couldn't find him. But it was a fantasy, and the State Department frowned on it. And they sent for me to come back to Algiers to be sent back home. And as we rode our camels back from Busada, my Arab, and I wish I could remember his name. Called a burnoose. A burnoose is a cape like a fair with a hood on it. And I thought it was the most glamorous and gorgeous garment I had ever seen, and I really wanted it. And it was okay. He liked my navy raincoat with the built-in lining, you know. So we traded. And when they did send me home, and very nice luxury liner, State Department did things very nicely. I hope they still do. And I wore this as an evening wrap. And, you know, ladies can do wonderful things with capes. We swirl them around and we flirt. And I would lurk in corners. And I would pull my cape over and peer out at people. I thought I was a spy. I was weird. I never went to jail. I was taken to jail one time in a paddy wagon, the Black Maria, the most miserable, humiliating experience of my entire life. I'm from a coal mining area where Saturday night was payday and a big time, and Sunday morning gossip over the fence was, did you see who picked up the paddy wagon last night? The Black Maria went to so-and-so's home. And I grew up with the knowledge that the Black Maria was a terrible, terrible disgrace. And so when the Black Maria came for me, it was a terrible, terrible disgrace, but it didn't stop me from drinking. It took me to a jail somewhere in Arlington, Virginia, and in a complete blackout, I made a phone call. And I called the city manager of Alexandria, who was a dear old friend from Army days. His name was Dutch Willard. And Dutch came and got me out. But in the few brief moments of lucidity that I had there, I looked into the cell. I wasn't booked, I wasn't put into the cell, but I could see it. And I saw that bear cot, and I saw that bear toilet bowl. And I said, how is a nice lady like me getting a place like this? And not too long ago, maybe a year or so ago, I spoke with a young man who was out on a pass from the local institution. And he told how they could get alcohol in prison, and they got drunk in prison. And if they couldn't get it, they made it. And they made it in the toilet bowl. And I said, I could have been me. It could have been. I should have been in jail. I should have been in institutions. But I had enablers, and I had the people that probably prolonged my drinking until the time came when I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous after I had exhausted all of the rules. And so I came home and I went the hospital route. My first hospitalization while I was in the Navy was 3 days. And they told me it was something like cat fever. Today I know, of course, it was 3 days of drying out from alcoholism. A little later, I was hospitalized again, maybe 5 days. It was taking longer. Our disease is progressive, you young people. It doesn't stop where you are now. Your disease will get worse, even as you stay sober. My disease is progressing even as I stay sober, 34 years. I know this from the experience of others, and I believe the experience of others, and that's what we share here, experience and strength and hope. And what you're seeing here today is like 3,000 people sharing experience, strength, and hope with the new people and with each other to sustain our sobriety, sustain this alcoholic brain that keeps coming to the forefront and say, ha, maybe I'm not. I still go to a lot of meetings. I'm not going to 6 and 7 a week anymore, but I'm sure trying to make 3 and 4. And I just looked at my calendar, and I'm going to be in Villa some tradition meetings in the month of November that's going to keep me hopping 4 days a week, just on traditions alone. And I never turn them down because traditions to me are so important, and I hope they are to you. Last hospitalization was in 1955. I have been asked by the State Department to resign, and I wrote that letter of resignation, which they had prepared for me, really. And I started for Florida. I started for Florida because I had married a merchant marine sailor I'd met over in Italy. And if you invite me back, I'll tell you that story, because that takes another 45 minutes. Complete marvelous person, but he was alcoholic also. And he was a merchant marine captain. And he signed me on as his purser, and I was the only woman on a Liberty ship called the Fred Joyce, and it was fun. But I was going to divorce him, and I headed for Jacksonville, Florida, and I read in an almanac that you could get an easy, quick divorce in Florida. I don't know what year the almanac was, but it didn't work too well. But it was there in Jacksonville that I nearly died. I was drinking around the clock in 1955. And I called a cousin. One of the many calls I made was to my cousin in Miami, Florida. And she, in turn, called Alcoholics Anonymous at the San Marco Club of Jacksonville, Florida. And two members of the San Marco Club in Jacksonville, Florida, came to see me. And there were two ladies dressed so beautifully. And one said, "My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic." And she had on a white dress without a spot on it. And her nails had been manicured, and her hair was freshly washed and coiffed, and she was beautiful. And I looked at her, and I said, "You're an alcoholic?" And she said, "Yes." And the other lady, equally as pretty, and she said she was an alcoholic, and I wanted what they had. And that's how I began my AA, thinking I didn't stay sober immediately. I was a very sick cookie. But from then on, until January of 1956, I owe my life to those people who kept me going from one hospital to another, even though I drank. The last hospital they got me into in September. And I was there at this time of the year, October, November, and December. 4.5 months I was in somebody's hospital, first in the Duval County Hospital in Florida, and then eventually to the Veterans Hospital in Salisbury, North Carolina. And right here, along with thanking the committee for inviting me, I want to thank the gentleman who gave the committee my name, a gentleman from North Carolina named Dave C. Dave C., thank you very much. He told me when I saw him in Seattle at the International Convention, I said, "Dave, thank you so much for giving my name to Gloria, the program chairman." And he says, "Oh, you're going to enjoy that." I want to tell you, he understated that. This convention is one of the greatest I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot. Thank you very, very much.